You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
Hello, dear listener. Welcome to another hour of Fun with Economics with Anne. I'm your host, and Kev, who is on the line. How are you going, Kev?
I'm going well, Anne. I'm still in sunny Taree at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So hello to our listeners from Taree, which is just north of Newcastle, about an hour and a half north of Newcastle, the home of Bill Mitchell and coffee.
The Centre of Full Employment and Equity.
Yeah, so just up the road from there. But it's just turning into spring here. It's quite pleasant.
You've spent a few weeks in Taree now. What's keeping you there?
I've been here for about a month and a half. Well, the idea was to get out of Melbourne during winter because it's not much fun being in a van in Melbourne during winter. You have to shut the doors and it's cold.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have gone travelling, but I decided to try and just settle into the community here. And mm-hmm. it's going quite well. I've picked up a bit of handyman work. And I've joined the local rowing club, and I'm rowing with them three or four times a week.
On the river?
Yeah, and it's an interesting rowing club. Like rowing's a bit of an elitist sport because it's kind of like it's a sport that private schools offer.
Yeah, you often you see them on the Arrow, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's the kind of background to it. But Taree has this magnificent rowing club, and it's a public rowing club.
Okay.
And it's run by, The first president was a guy called Lucky, who I still see every now and again. He turns up quite regularly.
Okay.
And he's a builder from Taree. And 50 years ago, he got an apprentice, and that's Tony. And he said, well, if you're going to be an apprentice of mine, you need to join the rowing club. So it's this blend of these country boys who are seriously strong. Like, you jump in the boat with these guys.
Uh-huh.
And I just have images of them walking around their farm with a cow under one arm and a hay bale under the other.
Are you keeping up with them, okay?
Oh, they're not to be messed with, I can tell you. Mm. You know, there's a blend of people who went to private schools in Sydney and the local crew, and it's really enjoyable. It's a nice place.
Have any of them become Radio MMT listeners, do you think?
Quite the opposite. Well, actually, there's one guy there. There was this one guy who I just presumed was like a country boy who went to boarding school, etc. He was an advisor to Bill Hayden during the Whitlam years.
A fellow
called Howard, and he is amazing to talk to. So I found a lefty. He's good. Mm. But being a country town, it's mainly national voters up here.
It's a slow process of conversion for you, Kev.
Well, Baz and I have a little run-in on quite a regular basis.
That's van life. That's Kev reporting in about the latest of van lifing.
Well, the show is kind of about this because van lifing means that I don't have to pay rent or electricity bills, which frees me up from the capitalist clutches of being trapped
from
by
the rentier, Kev.
Yeah. I stopped renting and I jumped in my van and it allows me a freedom of life that I wouldn't be able to achieve if I had to be paying rent to some mongrel bloody landlord. But you know what I mean? That's the basis of my existence.
There's a level of financial freedom you've gained there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to have you cast your mind back, Kev, to Sunday the 31st of August.
Right.
That was when a group of about 40 young men, led by a self-professed neo-Nazi, they conducted a premeditated and racist attack on a space in Melbourne here called Camp Sovereignty. Now, the camp is a sacred space of peace and healing that was established over 12 months ago by Elder and actually a presenter here at 3CR who does a couple of shows here, and that was Uncle Robbie Thorpe. Now, violence is always shocking, I think, even if you're kind of half expecting something to erupt. And I have to admit that I was truly shocked by just how brazen the attack was, because it happened in broad daylight and these people didn't even bother trying to disguise who they were. But also shocked by the level of brutality of this attack, because they were hitting people with wooden and metal sticks.
Yeah, I saw video of them, you know, laying the boot in unprovoked.
Yeah.
This was an assault, like you say.
It was. And I think one of the women ended up in hospital with a concussion. Now, concussions are pretty serious. Like, you can be feeling the effects of those for literally months or years after. Like, they're not small things. So, you know, I hope for good healing for those people who are on the front lines of that kind of violence. But I would like to focus on the good news as well, Kevin. And my faith in humanity was restored a little bit when the following weekend, thousands of people gathered at Camp Sovereignty to show their solidarity with First Nations people.
But, you know, like that demonstration, they'll always say, oh, there's people on the left who are extreme as well, like extinction, et cetera. Except they're not violent. They do things like hang from a bridge or actions against the capital, which is destroying the planet. They're bringing attention to a cause. So to say that the extreme left is just as bad as the extreme right is not a comparison. But so-called politicians of the conservative nature, they kind of dog whistle them and sort of give them license and embolden them, you know. And then you combine that with the stuff that's happening over in the US and people saying, well, this is the way of the world now. You know, these right-wing nutjobs just go, right, well, this is a worldwide movement, therefore it must have some credibility.
No, well, if that's how you express your ideology through taking swipes at someone with a metal bar, I mean, your ideology is rubbish as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you're a knucklehead, you know.
Well, you know, the intersections between economics and racism, they are longstanding and they are complex. And, you know, Kev, I kind of think that if we had an economy that was really about leaving no one behind, I mean, I'm not naive enough to think it would eliminate racism, but I do think it would inoculate our society much more against these racist attitudes feeling brazen enough to show their faces in broad daylight.
Well, look, now here's a challenge for the left, because that these right-wing protesters are mainly young men who are angry about their circumstances. They're angry that that the world isn't working out for them like they thought it should. And they're blaming the wrong people, and they've been picked up by the right who have manipulated. But a lot of their causes are the same as the people on the left, which is that they don't like the way the world's running because they've been left behind. They've been chewed up by capital and spat out and left behind.
Right.
But they've found the wrong focus to express that discontent. And it's a challenge of us on the left to connect with these people. Both sides who are feeling disenfranchised here are being done over by the same people.
That's right.
So there we go. There's our challenge, Anne. And there's a challenge to all the listeners out there. You know a right-wing nut job, and I do know a couple of them, actually. Try and figure out a better way to resolve these issues.
Yeah. I do think that we do need a new economic vision, Kevin. And this episode, what we're going to be hearing is some of the speakers who spoke at the forum called A New Economic Vision. And we mentioned this back on episode 58 of Radio MMT. And this forum was held at Victorian Trades Hall on the 15th of August. And it was kind of like a way of airing some ideas that in an ideal world, I think a braver Labor government might take up some of these ideas. But before we hear from those speakers, one thing I couldn't help notice was that a few days after this forum at Trades Hall, the Labor government itself decided it was going to talk about its vision for the economy, and it held an economic roundtable, they were calling it, where the select few were invited to Canberra. Now, Labor, of course, are governing with a comfortable majority at the moment, and this roundtable seemed to be their way of holding up a cautious finger to the wind to test which way the consensus might be blowing on economic ideas. Unfortunately, at the time, there was a lot of talk about cutting red tape, and I don't like that phrasing at all because, yeah, it implies that all regulation is bad regulation. It's a really neoliberal way of framing things.
Yeah, we're talking a neoliberal conversation. We're talking within a neoliberal framework a lot of the time. You know, they're talking about increasing productivity and deregulating. I mean, it's a conversation which is being steered and is geared towards the interests of capital.
That's right. And, you know, I did hear a few positive things in that lead up to that discussion. Like, I was hearing things about more funding for schools and higher education and new investment in wind and solar and battery storage. But I don't know how far any of that went.
And that's all pretty obvious. Those are election-winning comments from the Labor Party. Right. You know, there's nothing radical coming out of that. Like, they could have said those things back in the 90s, you know?
So true.
Yeah.
Another phenomenon that was surrounding all this talk before, during and after this economic roundtable was how this discussion was framed in terms of the federal government's so-called bottom line, meaning, of course, their budget bottom line.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can hear that you're ready to go on that one, but before you do, let's have a listen to some examples of how this framing was playing out. We've got Schwartz Media's 7am, The Guardian's Full Story, and the Australia Institute's Follow the Money, and the ABC News Insiders talking about the economic roundtable.
Hi, I'm Daniel James. A hand-picked group of people from business, unions and government will gather in Canberra for an economic roundtable. The Prime Minister is watching carefully to see which ideas gain traction and which are political poison. Press gallery journalist Karen Middleton on Anthony Albanese's long game and the way he wants to change the economy to change the country.
The underlying theme really is to come up with an agenda for economic reform.
Further economic reform to drive growth, boost productivity, strengthen the budget, and secure the resilience of our economy.
They've laid out some conditions for the ideas that come forward, and one of those key conditions is they can't be a cost to the budget bottom line. Budget bottom line.
Budget bottom line. Budget bottom line. Budget bottom line. Bottom line.
They've also got a huge problem with things built into the economy that cost an enormous amount of money, like the Medicare system, like the PBS, pharmaceutical benefit scheme, like the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and they have to find ways to pay for it. What we're not sure about is whether they're inclined to cut back on their spending or whether they're really just looking for revenue-raising measures to help pay for what they want to do. The thing is, if they're not going to make changes to tax, it's not very clear how exactly they can raise revenue. So it seems impossible to do that without tackling some substantial things around tax.
Regid Ahmed here. And do we need to increase productivity so the government can take more tax and get into surplus, or is it to lift living standards to give us higher wages?
I think it's both. The government wants to grow the pie in order to pay for the services that we all rely on, health and education, the justice system, the welfare system, all these kinds of things. There is a huge structural problem in the federal budget. We're consistently spending a lot more money than we're taking in as a country. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has put some guardrails on proposals. They must be broadly budget neutral or positive. They must be economy-wide and not particularly targeted to one sector.
That was Chief Political Correspondent Tom McElroy.
You know, it's not going to harm Australia in any way to tax gas. In fact, if the government then uses that to add to the government services that can be productivity enhancing. Think about if we made education cheaper. Tertiary education, for example, degrees are becoming incredibly expensive, and that encouraged people to go out and become better educated. That will improve productivity. So there's all kinds of productivity enhancing things the government can do if it has the revenue, to do so.
Mm.
And this is a way that the government can get a whole heap of revenue.
Australia Institute senior economist Matt Gridnoff. I'm Ebony Bennett, deputy director at the Australia Institute.
I'm David Spears. Well, my guest this morning is Treasurer Jim Chalmers. On spending, there was support at the round table from the likes of Ken Henry, Kerry Schott, Allegra Spender and others for at least some sort of rules to be put into the budget around spending. I know you've delivered two surpluses, but spending has been creeping up. Why don't you put some sort of rules around the level of spending?
Well, first of all, there are fiscal rules. That's the first point. Secondly, when we came to office, spending as a share of the economy was almost a third. We got it down to closer to a quarter. Of the dishonest and hypocritical things that our political opponents say about the economy and the budget, they had fiscal rules which weren't worth the paper that they were written on. They failed every test that they set for themselves. They said there'd be surpluses, there were deficits. They said they would get debt down. It's skyrocketed.
You said there are fiscal rules.
And our approach,
what is the rule on spending?
That's what I'm getting to, David.
And are you going to change it?
Well, our rules are set out in the budget, and they are about banking most of the upward revision to revenue, which we've been doing. They're about improving the budget position over time, which is what we've been doing. You kindly mentioned the two surpluses, but also the $100 billion in savings, the $207 billion positive turnaround in the budget, the biggest nominal improvement in a budget in a single term ever. We've got the debt down $177 billion. We're saving $60 billion in debt interest. The difference between us and them is they had fiscal rules that they failed on almost every occasion. We've got fiscal rules in our budget. There is a view about tightening them up around the room in the economic reform roundtable. But what really matters here is the outcomes. If you think about the outcomes that we've delivered, the budget is in much better nick than it was when we found it.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
That was the Radio MMT roundup of the roundtable.
It's just frustrating, Anne. It's frustrating to hear. Like, the whole conversation is captured by neoliberal claptrap. You know, this whole balancing the budget thing as if the government is constrained by tax revenue or how much it can borrow. If you've been listening to this show for long enough, you know that that's a load of rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
The government always spends as much as it needs to when it has to, which tells you that it has an infinite.
It can never run out of the dollars.
No, and I thought Jim Chalmers was going to say something good there. He said it's about the outcomes. He said it's about the outcomes. And the outcomes are things like good health, good education, good well-being. And he starts talking about the budget bottom line is a good outcome. You know, and you just go, mate, you know.
The financial outcomes are not the point. You know, it's so interesting that even before they started this roundtable, they put in what they called the guardrails around the discussion. So this was the idea that none of the proposals that came out of the roundtable could affect this budget bottom line. So that's effectively saying that you can't give us any kind of a spending idea that requires any kind of deficit spending. And so what that means is that they're not going to go near any of the big ideas that we really need.
Yeah, I mean, how do you reckon Milton Friedman must be feeling? Like, he started this joke, you know, 45 years ago, and it just won't end. It just goes on and on.
It goes on and on because there we've got Albanese saying he wants to strengthen the budget, and that implies that the government's in danger of running out of money, which it is not. The federal government cannot run out of the dollars. And then we've got Chalmers talking about this bit of jargon that he uses, which is banking the upward revision to revenue.
Banking it. You are the bank.
That sounds like he's socking away all this money in the bank, which, of course, the federal government does not do, and they don't save and they can't save money. It's not how it works when they do their spending.
Any money that goes to the government is destroyed. Any money that comes out of the government is created. It's like that's a very simple rule of thumb for our listeners out there, is that when the government spends, it creates money. And when the government receives money, it's destroyed. It's taken off the ledger, like literally.
It's just a matter of typing numbers into a computer.
I had a good with my rowing mate, Paz, the other day. He says, oh, we need companies to make money in this country. That's what we need. And I said, the only entity that makes money in this country is the government. Everybody else uses the money or collects the money. But there's one organisation that makes the money. That's the RBA, and that's on behalf of the government.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. He told me to be quiet.
It's still not landing there in Taree,
no,
hey?
No.
But you know, the unfortunate thing about all this is that, you know, I didn't hear any of the big ideas coming out of this roundtable, which for me would have been something like a state-owned banking option or putting the brakes on the finance and extractive industries. We didn't hear anything about that. We didn't hear anything about fully funding and building public housing. And
no.
Certainly didn't hear my favourite one. I didn't hear anyone talk about creating the Federal Department of Biocapacity so that we can keep the national economy within planetary boundaries.
But the object of the neoclassical economists, their focus is on the government's bottom line, this fictional bottom line.
Treating the government like a household.
Yes, correct.
And in fact, going back to the forum that was held at Trades Hall, Colin Long, who is the Just Transitions organiser there at Victorian Trades Hall, he was speaking in more detail about why it is so counterproductive to talk about the federal government as though it needs to tax us in order to get money to spend. So back on episode 58, we did speak with Colin ahead of the forum, but here he is again as introduced at the forum by Owen Bennett.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Colin Long, Just Transition Organiser here at Victorian Trades Hall Council. Thank you, Colin.
Thanks, Owen. This building is built on the struggle for shorter hours. It only exists because of the struggle for the 8-hour day in the 1850s. And struggle for control over working hours is fundamental to what unions have been doing for 170-odd years. It does need to turn into a serious campaign. I say let's call it a 30-hour week so people can work 5 days, shorter hours, whatever they want, combined with the job guarantee. Put the two of those things together. That would be a very strong campaign. But before we're able to really talk about either shorter hours or particularly a job guarantee, we're going to have to talk about what is preventing us from advocating for these sorts of policies and getting there. And we need to understand, we really need to have a proper understanding of what resources are needed, especially public resources, if we're going to have a job guarantee. And this is where I'm going to say some things which are probably challenging some of the sacred cows of so much of public discourse on the right or left, because the right and left run a unity ticket on some really stupid things, particularly around the issue of tax. Most on the left and the centre-left, the discourse on tax is entirely wrong. The standard trope on the left and the centre-left is that we need to improve the revenue side of the fiscal equation. We have to tax the rich to provide the services that the rest of us need. The Greens ran very strongly on this in the last election, and they're explicit. We have to tax the rich if we're going to have the things we need, like healthcare and education. A lot of people think, yeah, well, of course, we need to tax the rich to get the things we need. That has a number of effects. It means we need rich people and rich corporations to provide good public services. So it means the left continues to advocate for the existence of rich people and rich corporations. That's what we do all the time. I find that bizarre. It leads to self-inflicted constraints on the government's ability to provide decent public services and to deal with the great crises we currently face, like the climate disaster that is underway. We can only provide these services, we tell ourselves, and deal with these crises if we can get the money from rich people. What a bizarre thing to think. Thirdly, it leads us to focus almost entirely on the concept of redistribution. Redistribution's important, but it can't be all that we talk about as leftists. It neglects the question which should be uppermost in our minds, in my view, of how wealth is created in the first place. It leads us to forget about the one thing leftists should really care about, and that is who owns the means of production. When did we stop thinking about that? Partly because all we think about is redistribution and getting money off rich people that we can give to poor people. Why should we allow small fractions of the capitalist class to extract Australia's mineral wealth for their own profit? Why should we allow the techno-feudalists to manipulate and commodify every aspect of human existence down to consciousness itself now in the interest of their own profits? Why should we rely on private investors motivated by private profit to deliver sufficient renewable energy to avoid catastrophic climate change? That's what we're doing. If the private capitalists don't make enough money, we're not going to have enough renewable energy. And we're all fine with that, apparently. It leads us to give, fourthly, private capitalists, particularly rentiers, much greater importance than they should have. It allows them to obfuscate, lie and dissemble with fake promises about how much benefit their projects will provide if only we reduce regulation to allow them to deliver their promises of abundance. Adani has paid no corporate tax into the coffers of the Australian government, none. And yet the education and healthcare systems have not collapsed without Adani's riches. How odd. Fifthly, this focus on taxing the wealthy to provide things that we need distracts us from considering the truly important issues. For instance, in dealing with the decarbonisation of the Australian economy, it is becoming increasingly obvious that one of the hindrances is a lack of skilled labour. But we're wasting a whole lot of labour. We're wasting 3 million people's labour because we have these forced underemployment and forced unemployment. But there's no fiscal restraint on the federal government investing in renewable energy or energy efficiency, retrofitting. There's a whole lot of houses out there. Australian houses are basically tents with doors. We could do a whole lot of work to fix the standard of Australian housing. Or anything else we need to do to move to a sustainable economy. There's no fiscal restraint for the federal government to do that. We don't need to have a big debate about the need to raise more revenue to make this shift. We need to work out what the real constraints are and devise ways to overcome them. Taxation may play a part in this, but not as a revenue-raising mechanism. That's not what it's for. One constraint is the need to acquire equipment and machinery, solar panels, etc. We have to work out what is the most efficient and socially useful thing to do. Is it better to buy cheap Chinese solar panels, conceding the benefits of a solar panel manufacturing industry to China, but reaping the benefits to reduce the costs for other businesses? Or should we manufacture solar panels in Australia? They're the sorts of discussions we should be having. The labour constraint is one that the tax debate is essentially irrelevant to. We have a lot of wasted labour in this country, and that would be what the benefit of a job guarantee would be. It would put that labour to good use with appropriate training and so on, and make sure there is no forced unemployment, which of course would improve the position of labour in the economy and would improve the position of organised labour. One of the causes of labour shortages, labour shortages for sustainable jobs, is a continued expansion of the fossil fuel industry. This absorbs workers into an industry that continues to destroy the planet. Anyone can see that it is better for the climate and the environment and labour force planning to stop new fossil fuel projects ever getting to the stage where they might earn sufficient income to pay tax. The focus on tax as a source of revenue also leads us to neglect probably the most important function, to reduce reliance on things we don't want, like smoking or fossil fuels, and to reduce the power that accrues to wealth. Yes, it's important to tax the rich, but that is because we want to permanently reduce the power that comes from being wealthy, not because we need their money for goods and services the rest of us need. So if we're going to have a proper discussion about a job guarantee or labour market issues more generally, then we have to have a much better discussion. And we need to stop these nonsense discussions about the revenue side of the fiscal equation. It's time for leftists to stop making the case for why we need rich people and rich corporations.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
And we just heard from Colin Long, who was speaking at the New Economic Vision Forum at Victorian Trades Hall. And he was saying that we really don't have to worry about the revenue side of the fiscal equation and to break down that economic jargon. Every time you hear the word fiscal, we're really just talking about the federal government's ability to tax and spend. And the revenue side of that is the taxing. And the confusion that happens is that people think that the taxing is income for the federal government, which it is not.
Let's dispel this word revenue, government revenue. Revenue is money destroyed. So what do you call it? That's I don't know.
I think literally it does mean money returned to the government, which is correct. But then people think that that is income and it's not. It is simply money that's being returned in order to be destroyed, as you say.
It's put in the incinerator, yes. No, government doesn't need revenue. Geez, he speaks well, Colin Long, doesn't he? But, that whole point about we don't need the rich, like the left, when people on the left say that we need to tax the rich more so that we can afford things, it's just complete nonsense, and it's falling right into the hands of the neoliberals.
Exactly, it's playing into the hands, isn't it, of the neoliberals.
Yeah.
There was another big issue that came out of the economic roundtable in Canberra, and this was the productivity question, which kind of boils down to how do you do more with what you have? So how do you do more with the resources that you've got, for example, labour and your minerals and your land and so on?
Yep.
And the thing was, when people were talking about this, they didn't stop to ask, well, what are we doing more of and why? If they're trying to increase productivity, they did not ask, well, who's going to get the benefit of the productivity?
Who's going to reap the benefit of it? Yeah.
That's right. And that question is actually a question of distribution, which I think might have been a taboo word there in Canberra. But person who was brave enough to talk about distribution was, of course, economist Bill Mitchell, who is the founder of Modern Monetary Theory, which, of course, is what Radio MMT is all about. And I noticed in his blog post on the roundtable, he said, it's not true that we need more output growth via productivity growth to improve material conditions. So the improving productivity growth is not the primary question. And unlike most commentators, Bill was not shy about saying that the government must achieve more equity without adding any extra spending pressure to the economy if it wants to pursue a degrowth strategy. In that case, it has to take purchasing power off the high income earners and transfer it to the lower income earners. So in other words, what he's saying is that the equity and the environmental concerns are linked. And what's going on here is that the neoliberal strategy to deal with this link is to just say grow, grow, grow. And in amongst all that growing, we won't have to harm any of the income earning potential of the wealthy, and maybe the less wealthy will get a few crumbs. Whereas what we're saying is that we need distribution and not just this blind growth mentality.
Well, the growth mentality ignores the impact. The growth over the centuries has never had to really regard pushing the natural environment to the extent that it's now pushed. It's regarded the natural environment as something that will either repair or they'll go and exploit somewhere else.
Exactly.
That's the model, you know. So to keep that same model now when it's run into its boundaries, and then to have people like Barnaby Joyce saying, oh, we can't afford to look after the environment, that's where you make your money. No environment, no...
Yeah, it's reached its expiry date, that mentality. And in fact, there are two mechanisms for distributing the benefits of productivity, whether or not you're increasing it, and distributing that to not just workers, but to the entire working class, including unemployed workers. And two of those mechanisms are, one, the shorter working week, and two, the job guarantee. So let's hear more about these two mechanisms from the panel speakers at the new Economic Vision Forum, as introduced by Owen Bennett, who is looking to start a unionist for the job guarantee.
Desiree Kay is National Director of the Tomorrow Movement, a youth climate justice movement fighting for a climate jobs guarantee.
So... 5 years ago, Tomorrow Movement, we launched a campaign for a climate jobs guarantee. Like, I guess I'm here representing the young people who are fighting for this vision. And really, when Tomorrow Movement first founded, we looked at the world and we looked at the crises that we faced. I guess at that time, whenever you talk to young people about things like the cost of living or the economic crises, they would always tell you about climate. And so this intersectional sort of movement that was fighting for good jobs, great public services, and a safe climate for all, that was like what we were trying to do. We want a society where there's dignity for all and equality, and we want a good future where we are safe and we feel like we can have a good life. Like, that's really at the crux of what this, like, all this policy stuff is trying to serve. You know, working in the youth movement, we see the way that young people are disillusioned by politics and don't actually think that the government can do good things. We need the government to prove us wrong by actually delivering and telling a really hopeful story about the future that we can have, because currently in our context we have like a poly crisis. It's not just climate and the economic crisis and jobs and housing. Like, what we've seen happen is like the rise of the far right is like this response to people wanting a real answer for how do we live good lives in the future, and the governments throughout the world aren't delivering. We need something different and more visionary and I guess like maybe more progressive and populist than governments have been willing to do in the past. For the government to spend big, have a really high ambition and actually build the things that we need to guarantee our future, Labour needs to be brave and be as ambitious as they can be. What we need is a really strong movement on the left who can create those conditions for a vision of a much more just society. So I guess that's part of the work in like building things like this jobs guarantee, but, you know, in the service of a bigger vision for a more just society.
Dr. Karina Garland is the Federal Labor Member for Chisholm and former Assistant Secretary of the Victorian Trades Hall Council. Please make Karina feel welcome.
The issue of acting on climate, on being optimistic about the opportunities in the future, is very widely and deeply felt in the community. And so I think that does give the government the mandate to act as we have already been acting. Obviously, the just transition is something we need to do to be able to harness the opportunities of a, you know, carbon zero economy. But the work's already begun. And so I really want to make clear that this isn't something that is a problem that has not begun to be solved yet. I think where we see things already happening is through the establishment of the Net Zero Economy Authority, for instance. So jobs arrive before plants in various communities shut. Part of that is the Energy Industry Jobs Plan, which is a job-to-job pathway. So workers from closing coal and gas plants can move straight into new roles with another employer in the same region. It's about matching skilled workers to vacancies across multiple employers, making sure they get to keep their livelihoods. There's also a skills-first approach to a lot of this too. So if there needs to be more training, it's able to be accessed very easily. So workers can move from coal and gas into renewables, hydrogen, into transition and into manufacturing. There's First Nations participation too, which means that it's going to targeted support for First Nations workers and businesses to share in the opportunities. So I think the role of government is absolutely to ensure workers' land is secure, better paid, and union jobs in the same communities. Renewables create construction and operation roles as well. You know, electricians, scaffolders, civil crews, control room operators, environmental science and land management jobs are created there. And they're actually, in fact, better paid jobs than the jobs that people have transitioned from. The offshore wind off the Latrobe Valley, which is part of the story that we want to tell of opportunity and what's possible. When you keep workers in place, it keeps the community strong. It means that the schools get to stay open. It means that the small businesses stay busy, and it keeps the clubs and services thriving. It means hospitals don't shut down. And something that is on the agenda for this next term of government is to bring in stronger procurement codes for government, good, secure jobs in procurement. Government obviously has a really big lever when it comes to government spending and where that money gets spent and how it gets spent. So the secure Jobs Australia plan is something that we want to implement this term, which it builds on that in a national way. This is going to be subject to a consultation with unions, of course, but this is going to make sure that government money is spent supporting businesses that create secure jobs, create well-paid jobs, and work with communities. There's two other parts to this too that sometimes get forgotten in this conversation: automation and AI. So I think it's good that we are having a conversation nationally about where to with AI, because I think there is the possibility that people get left behind. Of course there is. I mean, I think there's something quite perverse about the fact that at the point we're recognising the importance of feminised jobs and care and service work and empathy and those important human qualities, we're seeking to replace a lot of those feminised service and care functions with robots through AI. And, you know, I don't think there's ever really been a plan for what happens when you need to transition workers out of those kinds of jobs. So I think that principle of when we have technologies, how do we make sure people don't get left behind, how do we create those pathways, is really important. And that is absolutely not just the job of government, but it's in consultation with unions, employers and the community at large.
Before we welcome our next speaker, I thought it would be a good idea to give a little bit of context about where Australia is right now. Just prior to today, I had a look at the ABS to see how many people are looking for work in Australia. So when you look at the amount of unemployed people, the ABS count, the amount of underemployed people, the ABS count, and the amount of hidden unemployed people, so they're people who aren't counted by the official statistics but actually would want work if it's available, we're looking at around 3 million people. That's a lot of people that we're talking about. So Unions for a Job Guarantee doesn't shy away from how big this project is and how ambitious it is, and that's what today is all about. And looking at the other side of that is our unemployment policy system, where those people who are collecting unemployment benefits, it's less than half of the Henderson poverty line, and those people are required to participate in Work for the Dole. They're required to participate in a privatised employment services system that's built on punishment. So these are the sort of things that we're thinking about at Unions for Job Guarantee. All right, I'd like to welcome Secretary of the United Workers Union, Tim Kennedy, to the stage.
To see economic reform elevated as a priority by this government is undoubtedly a very good thing, and a long time in the coming. As we know, the potential for a two-term Labor government is a big deal. For those of my generation, these opportunities don't come around that often. And we don't want to squander it. This is a good time to think big in terms of economic reform. We've been thinking about this at the union for a long time, and we've got a range of ideas in our union. It's a broad church. It strikes me that this idea of a jobs guarantee is something that allows people to live a full and free life. And this has got me thinking about the additional complementary measures that align with this vision. So in reflecting on the topic of economic reform, there are several questions that are important to the way I like to approach the issue. What is the role of work in our modern society? What does it mean to live with dignity? And what do we need to do now to ensure that the future is sustainable, not just in terms of industry, but the climate and the natural world as well? So there are some obvious and relatively simple interventions that could radically change the lives of workers for the better. Wages got to outpace the cost of living. We've got a lot of repair work to do there. Good conditions and benefits are fundamental to a decent life. Safe workplaces, something that we organise around every day on the job. And greater employment security. Our union's always fought for jobs you can count on. So the union movement generally is well versed in these claims, but today I actually wanted to talk about something that's dropped off as a core demand in recent decades by unions, and that's the issue of a shorter working week. It's back on again, so it's timely. So ACTU leadership called for a shorter working week, and it kind of clearly reflects the spirit of our times. The push on the working week is an idea that its time has come. But there was a very swift response. Within a couple of hours, you could see how sensitive capital was to this. And they know it's popular. And ultimately, the swift response to knock this down is about control and maintaining control. But in an age of overwork and underwork, a look at distribution is an urgent and an interesting way to get into this issue of jobs guarantee. So for wage labourers, work is carved up into hours and paid accordingly. Work is done in time. Having a sense of agency over one's time is fundamental to living a good life. Almost 100 years ago, back in 1930, John Maynard Keynes famously predicted a 15-hour working week by the year of 2030. We've got 5 years to go. The idea was that people would be able to meet their material needs with a much shorter working week, ushering in a new era of leisure, or as he wrote it in his essay at the time, to live wisely and agreeably and well. Unfortunately, Keynes was mistaken. Working hours have remained relatively high and unchanged for decades. The great big push probably topped out in late 70s, early 80s, and we hit some 35-hour weeks in parts of our industries. A big oversight of Keynes was the issue of distribution. Yes, productivity and material wealth has risen dramatically in 100 years, and his prediction was correct on that. He said the increase in the standard of living would actually increase between 4 and 8 times higher. In Australia, we've definitely hit that range since that time, but we're not working any less. A small percentage of people have been able to reduce their labour hours, yet continue to accumulate wealth, extract rents and the like. But for the rest of us who use our labour and our time to earn living, a shorter working week would be a radical intervention. A typical proposition that we talk about is a 4-day work week without a loss of pay. But it could also look like shorter days and greater flexibility. This would be especially useful for those with caring responsibilities. A shorter working week would provide a huge benefit to workers and to everyone in the community who would benefit from the care, the learning, the creativity that comes with that. Shorter working hours with no loss of pay could help rebuild several essential industries that are currently in crisis. For instance, we recently surveyed members in the early childhood education and found that the majority of our members and workers in this area are planning to leave the industry soon. It's a product of overwork. People working in early childhood education, we're opening the centres at 6:30, and then the people who actually run those centres will be still doing meetings at 6:30, 7:30 at night. There's a lot of people not being paid for that work. A shorter working week could be important in terms of resetting a working culture and allow people to kind of want to work again in these sectors and these industries in a sustainable way. Essentially, a shorter working week goes to the issue of how much time are we spending at work. The other side of the coin is time when we're at work. Across many of our industries, our members report feeling that they have no autonomy at all over their time at work. They're monitored minute to minute. The rise of AI and surveillance technologies is heightened this. The issue of micromanagement and work intensification are common across all parts of the workforce, and especially the areas that the United Workers Union organise in. Just last year, we saw Woolworths attempt through algorithm control management systems to control time spent on task, which creates unsafe working speeds. Even basic human indignities like having to have a bathroom break monitored minute to minute. These are the issues of time. Putting boundaries around what kind of workplace surveillance is permitted would go a long way to reclaiming a fundamental human right. Other measures we could support as a progressive approach around these issues is flexible working hours, when people start and when people finish, rostering security and appropriate work from home arrangements. These are basic things that we can choose to do now and would go a long way towards ensuring workers can live productive and well-balanced lives with enough time to do the things that really count in their lives. So what should the role of work be in our modern society? What does it mean to live with dignity? And so what can we do as a movement now to protect a more sustainable future for all? Progressive economy reform, economic reform is fundamental and crucial, and we have the opportunity now for progressive government.
It's great to have such a large and powerful union here today. It's easy to forget, but the union movement has a rich history in fighting for a more ambitious economic policy, particularly around full employment, particularly the blue-collar unions. It's great to see an AMW comrade here today. AMW really led many militant struggles for full employment during the Menzies period, when unemployment went above 2%, 2.5%. That was a crisis. The AMW had amazing campaigns. They marched to Canberra, to Parliament House, demanding full employment, which they defined as 2%. That's the history we have, and that's the history we need to remember and be inspired by.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
And I have to say, I thought the most interesting thing I heard from that forum was both Tim and Colin mentioning that the campaign for a shorter working week, sometimes they call it the 30-hour week, and a campaign for a job guarantee, they could be a powerful combination. They kind of fit together.
Yeah, well, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Because for listeners who aren't aware of the job guarantee, it's a scheme that would become the minimum wage and conditions. And if the job guarantee was set at 30 hours a week, then that would become the working week for many people.
Yeah, it's a vehicle for introducing a shorter working week if that's something that's a priority. And it looks like it is starting to be a priority for the union movement. So, you know, I always think unions have been interested in how you distribute the benefits of increased productivity to workers. And I, as an unemployment activist, I've always been interested in, well, how do you get to a full employment economy? And so those two things might be able to work in synergy now. And, of course, my idea of a full employment economy is that it's an essential characteristic of what I think of as a post-carbon, post-growth, steady-state donut economy.
Yeah, what's peeving me is, and I think people need to become aware of, is that so much of what they spend, what they earn and they spend, goes to so few. I was reading from Bill's book almost 2017 that 1% of the population owns half the wealth. Mm. And the other 99% of the population owns the other half. So 1% of the population owns the same amount of wealth as 99% of the rest of us. Mm. And that means that all these productivity gains are just making rich people richer.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not going to workers.
If and you're not distributing.
Mm. Yeah, they need to go to workers in the form of shorter working weeks and better pay. That needs to be shared.
So the other thing on the flip side to notice is that full employment doesn't mean that everyone's working flat chat. And
no,
it doesn't mean chewing through your resources as fast as you can. What it means is that everyone has access to a livable income and everyone's contributing according to their ability to work.
Everybody's got enough work to get by and they don't have to work 50 hours a week to do it. You know, like that quote that he made about John Maynard Keynes, I thought it was 20 hours a week, but it's 15 hours a week.
Yeah.
He knew what he was talking about, and that was before computerisation, before the whole digital technology.
Exactly, so long ago. So I think if a full employment campaign inspires you, I'd highly recommend you get in contact with Owen Bennett, who is looking to start a group around that via Trades Hall. So you could just Google Victorian Trades Hall Council and contact Colin Long and he'll pass any messages to Owen Bennett. But Kevin, we've got to get out of here. Next week we'll be hearing from Bill Mitchell, who was also a speaker at the forum.
And Emma Dawson as well.
From Emma Dawson.
Excellent.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks, Kevin.
Catch you again in a couple of weeks.
All right. See you soon.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.